Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the final scheduled week of the Senate meeting for the 2018 session. We also finally have a text of a final farm bill that was released last night. So this week we're catching up with Senators Durbin and Duckworth. We spoke with Senator Dick Durbin earlier this morning from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good to be with you.
I thought we'd start here in Illinois. As you know, central and southern Illinois were hit by a series of tornadoes last week. In particular, I'm thinking of the town of Taylorville. I wanted to ask you about FEMA funding, because I know this is something that you have tried to work on for years. Senator Duckworth sponsored a bill last year that failed that I believe was a version of what a bill you had originally sponsored back in 2012 after others devastating storms and tornadoes to try to change this formula for how FEMA helps local cities. Congressman Ronnie Davis, I know, sponsored a bill that took a different approach and that did become law. Are you satisfied right now with the way that FEMA calculates how much money is sent to you when we're thinking particularly about areas outside of Chicago?
No. And what it boils down to is this. I have, of course, witnessed many cities and towns, small towns, downstate towns that have been ravaged by tornadoes. And I saw Taylorville personally over the weekend with Governor-elect Pritzker and Lieutenant Governor-elect Stratton. And the damage is clearly there, not just to the individual homes, but also to the infrastructure in the towns. I stopped a long time ago saying, hang on tight, we're going to Washington to bring back the money. Because the formula that is currently written, even with Congressman Davis's change, does not give us a fighting chance when it comes to small town and rural America. And the reason we cannot change it is very obvious. We have a limited pool of money available for disasters. We have more and more disasters occurring. I think climate change has a direct impact on that. Tornadoes in December, for goodness sakes, those of us who've grown up in Illinois never had to worry about them except in the spring and summer, and now they're year-round. And because we have a limited pot of money, the communities that currently benefit from the formula that doesn't help small-town America don't want to change it. They want the damages that they incur to be compensated. They're not willing to give up resources to help others.
Senator, you mentioned climate change, and I'm thinking about the National Climate Assessment Survey that was released just after Thanksgiving, and that projected that the Midwest would have the most temperature increases than any other part of the country. And you mentioned, of course, we're thinking about more tornadoes, droughts, flooding. Do you think the federal government is planning ahead fiscally for these levels of natural disasters that we are predicting to see increase?
Absolutely not. The opposite is true. Just a couple weeks ago, I sat down with a CEO of an Illinois-based property and casualty insurance company. Those of us who know the insurance industry a little bit know that they focus more on weather and weather patterns than almost anything, because that is their exposure to damages and costs in the future. And this gentleman was telling me his property and casualty company no longer writes insurance on the coast, either the West Coast or East Coast, because of the hurricanes and problems that they've had in those areas. And he said, we've got increasing problems here in the Midwest. The reality is there. We have more and more exposure to extreme weather and the damages that result. It isn't just the environmentalists that are singing this song. The insurance companies are. And they are certainly objective because they're dealing with the hard facts and the dollars that need to be spent.
I wanted to shift to the federal government, a possible shutdown. I know that President Trump has signed a sort of a two-week stopgap measure that would fund some government agencies. The deadline now is December 21st. I know your colleagues Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are set to meet with the president later this morning over this issue of the shutdown and funding the border wall. Where are we at with that right now?
Well, of course, the Republicans have majority control of Congress and the White House. And at this point, it is within their power to pass a budget and to avoid a shutdown. But they have reached a point where many Republicans will not vote for a spending bill, period. And so in order to pass it, you need Democratic votes in the House and Senate. And that's why Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are sitting down with the president. The president has made what I consider to be an unrealistic request that we put in $5 billion for his wall. This was the wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. But aside from that for a moment, keep this in mind. We gave the president $1.3 billion to be spent in the last fiscal year for walls and fences on the border, and it still hasn't been spent. This notion that we need $5 billion immediately because of a caravan or something else is a fiction. If we are going to make sure that the border is safe, it goes way beyond some 19th century concept of a wall. When I ask the people who are experts, they say we need technology and personnel. I want to tell you, I'm ready to vote for that. I want border security. I think most Americans want border security. But this notion of some medieval wall subject to ladders and tunnels overcoming it is just the president stuck on a campaign theme that really isn't realistic.
And I wanted to just ask you in regards to that border wall. I know you sent a letter to Defense Secretary Mattis about this yesterday. As the top Democrat on the committee that authorizes Pentagon spending, first, is it the job of Congress to provide authorization for the Defense Department being involved in this project?
I think there's a limited activity that the troops can engage in, and they've been used by previous presidents for that. Secretary Mattis, I respect and voted for, and I think he's doing a fine job. And he understands there are limitations to what our men and women in uniform can do if sent to the border. They cannot engage in law enforcement. That is not their job, and it shouldn't be. That's for the Border Patrol and others. And I just want to say, this idea of sending the troops a few days before the last election to stop the assault of this so-called caravan and then keeping them there into January, which is now the plan, is extremely expensive and not necessary. The Border Patrol can handle this issue and should, and there are ways that we in Congress can avoid this problem, this confrontation on the border that we face. Dragging the military in at great cost and at inconvenience to these men and women in uniform, I don't think is a way to approach it.
And so when it comes to those several thousand Central American migrants who are currently living in camps on the U.S.-Mexico border, how do you think we should be responding as a country to this?
Well, I think there are two things. First, and there have been acknowledgments in this administration, what is bringing them to the United States? We know what it is. It is the lawlessness and gang activities of those drug cartels in the Central American countries. That's what's pushing them out. And as a consequence, they're coming here in desperation. So the first things first, it's our drug appetite in the United States that pushes the money and weapons back down into Central America to fuel these cartels and to give them strength. So let's be honest about that and do our best to reduce it. Secondly, we can find out whether people are entitled to asylum before they make a 1,000-mile journey to the border of the United States. President Trump closed down a program that President Obama had started where minors who felt that they were in danger and were seeking asylum could make the application in their home countries. They didn't have to show up at our borders to do it. President Trump closed it down. So the people started coming to the border saying, well, we'll apply for asylum at the border. And third, we need to have an orderly process for asylum seekers. There are people from Central America and around the world who have a legitimate concern about whether or not they're in danger of losing their lives. We as a nation for 60 years or more have said we are open to these people. We want to be careful that we don't allow anyone dangerous in. We can't let everyone in, but we should have an orderly process, and currently we don't.
When we're thinking about international affairs, I wanted to just ask you about your calling for the expulsion of the Saudi ambassador over the killing of journalist and American resident Jamal Khashoggi. That news has led to bigger conversations about our relationship with Saudi Arabia, whether it's the weapons that we sell that country or taxpayer dollars that are helping fund the brutal war in Yemen. How should the U.S. be thinking about, should we be rethinking our alliance with Saudi Arabia?
Yes, we should. And I think it's long overdue. You can go back to 9/11 and the fact that the terrorists who attacked the United States and killed 3,000 innocent Americans were from Saudi Arabia. Some of the most extreme forms of the Muslim religion have been exported from Saudi Arabia to Europe and other places, and we continue to fight the forces that have been generated by those beliefs. In addition to that, the Saudis invaded the country of Yemen and are now engaged in a war that has millions of people with their lives at risk. 85,000 children have died. Another 14 million are subject to a famine which can take their lives as well, and the United States should not support that Saudi effort in Yemen, period. The notion that somehow our taxpayers' dollars or our military are assisting the Saudis in this assault, this humanitarian disaster, is unacceptable. And finally, let me say a word about the Crown Prince. I was one of 12 senators, both parties, who received a briefing last week from the CIA director. We sat in this room for 30 minutes. 10 minutes into the conversation, there was no doubt in my mind that the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia either had knowledge beforehand or actually approved the assassination of Khashoggi. And for the president to argue otherwise is to ignore the reality that his intelligence agencies have produced.
How should we hold them accountable?
Well, I think the first thing is to expel this ambassador, who happens to be the brother of the Crown Prince. Expel them until we have an accountability and an investigation, and we have some people held responsible, including the Crown Prince, for his involvement in this. To ignore it is to ignore one of the most basic values our country has stood for. And we are, at this point, are being watched by the rest of the world to see if we approve this kind of authoritarian conduct, which continues. Secondly, cut off all assistance to Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war in Yemen. Third, measure the weapons we sell to make sure that they are used in the proper way for the defense of Saudi Arabia and not in offensive methods as they're doing in Yemen today.
Senator Durbin, last night the final text of the Farm Bill was released. The last one expired 2 months ago. Is this version of the bill something you'll be voting yes on or no?
I believe it will. We're looking at it to make sure the details comply with the general descriptions we've received. We passed a very similar farm bill in August. It has been tied up in the House of Representatives since. They want to get it done, the Republican House does, before the changeover with a new Congress and a Democratic House. So I think there's a good chance that we're going to pass this farm bill before the end of the year, and our farmers back home need it.
Earlier in the year, you included an amendment to the Farm Bill with Republican and Democratic senators that provided grant funding for emergency medical services in rural areas. Did that make it into the final version?
It sure did. I had to make one concession. My Republican co-sponsor, Pat Roberts of Kansas, said, I think we're going to have a better chance passing it in conference with Republican senators and congressmen if it's no longer the Durbin-Roberts bill, but rather the Roberts-Durbin bill. And I said, by all means, change
really?
The name of it. He changed the name of it, and they've included it in the farm bill. But it's a good program because the first responders, particularly in rural and downstate areas, are literally lifesavers. They need the best equipment. They need opportunities to apply for federal grants to make sure that many volunteer operations are saving lives in downstate Illinois.
When we think about Illinois, the new Congress looking ahead to January, and I'm thinking about Lauren Underwood and Sean Casten and Chuy Garcia, House Democrats. What advice do you have for them as they begin their first terms, especially for those who haven't held office before?
Three great new members, and I can tell you they're excited. I've met with all of them. We just gave them memos that we prepared with our staff of the outstanding issues we see in each of their districts. I've told them, assemble a good staff. But you're going to win your re-election in the first year you're in office, not in the second campaign year. You'll win it by being responsive back home to constituent needs and to focus on your district at home more than becoming a superstar in Washington. That'll take some time, and they're all going to reach that point. But focus on the home front. Make sure that you're dealing with the issues that people care about at home. That's the key to re-election.
Did you give that same advice to Governor-elect Jamie Pritzker?
Well, I didn't have to. He's all over that. And I'll tell you this, as a candidate, the reason that Tammy Duckworth and I stepped out and endorsed him in the primary with many good candidates in that primary was the attention which he had paid to downstate Illinois and the entire state. It's rare for a Chicago candidate to show that kind of concern. J.B. Pritzker and Juliana Stratton were downstate all the time. People knew him, they liked him, and it showed up in the final vote when he did very well downstate for a Democrat.
Looking ahead to January, will you be in Springfield for his inauguration?
I hope so, but I'm still waiting for Senator McConnell to announce my fate in January. He sets the calendar here, but I'd like to be back home. It'll be a great celebration.
Well, Senator Durbin, thanks for speaking with us this morning. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Natalie. Same to you.